The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
My name is Andrea. I think I know most of you. As many of you probably know, this past week, one of our dear Sangha friends, Rainbow, passed away. She passed away on Tuesday, early afternoon. And so for much of the past couple of weeks, many people in our Sangha have been visiting her and spending time with her in intensive care and then at her bedside once life support was removed. And so for me, and I think also for a number of people in our community, this it's a very moving experience and brings right to the forefront of our lives the meeting with illness and death. So the topic tonight is the heavenly messengers, which in the Buddhist tradition are aging, illness, and death. The traditional story about the heavenly messengers includes a fourth heavenly messenger. And that story is typically told about the Buddha as an experience that the Buddha had. But in looking through the suttas, I found actually that the Buddha told this story about not himself, but a previous Buddha, way back in eons and eons before. He supposedly knew this story through the reaches of his vast knowledge of the universe, that this previous Buddha had this encounter with these four heavenly messengers. So this story goes that this prince, that this previous Buddha was a prince, much as the Buddha Gautama, and that his father raised him in a very secluded environment, an environment full of sense pleasure, and that he didn't have much exposure to aging, illness, and death. Any exposure, actually, as the story goes. And one day, the prince asks his charioteer to drive him out into the countryside. And the charioteer agrees, and they drive out, and they see an old man doubled over, kind of walking with a limp, gray hair, no teeth, you know, really just an old man. And the Buddha is kind of shocked, or the prince, he wasn't a Buddha at that time. The prince is a bit shocked, and he said, "What is this? What is this person? What is this?" And his charioteer said, "Well, that's an old person." And the prince responded, "But are all of us destined to become old?" And the charioteer said, "Yes, no one is exempt from this. Everybody is liable to become old. Everybody has that nature to age." And then they went back to the palace. And according to the story, many, many, many years later, he took another drive out of the palace, mostly staying secluded in the palace all of these years. Actually, he went back to the palace and told his father what he'd seen, and his father decided to find even more entertainment to keep in the palace because he did not want him to be exposed to aging, illness, and death, because at his birth, it had been foretold that he had the marks of a great man, and that he would either become a great king or he would become a fully enlightened being. And the prince's father had the sense that if he encountered the heavenly messengers, that he would leave the palace and become a wandering ascetic. And so he wanted to keep him in the palace so he could become a great king. So after the prince told him about his experiencing seeing the sick man, he made it more entertaining to stay in the palace. So many, many years later, he took another trip out, and this time he saw somebody who was ill, somebody with fallen down by the side of the road, not able to move their body very well, foaming at the mouth. And he was shocked at this experience too, and again asked his charioteer what this was. And the charioteer said, "This is a sick person." And again he asked, "Are we all subject to this?" And he said, "Yes." Back to the palace. Father makes it even more pleasant to stay in the palace. Many years later, he goes out again and sees a funeral procession. And I guess in the time of the Buddha, the funeral procession, they carried the body on a bier. And so it was open. It was a body lying there on a bier. And the prince said, "And what is that?" And the charioteer said, "Well, that is a dead person." And the prince said, "Well, what makes him dead?" And the charioteer responded, "That he can no longer speak with his mother and father, that he's no longer able to move or act or speak or think." And again, the prince said, "And are we all subject to this?" And the charioteer said, "Yes, we will all die. We will all die." Prince went back to the palace. Same story. Then a fourth time he goes out. And the fourth time he went out, he saw a monk. He saw a renunciate. And this man's face, the monk's face, was so serene and so peaceful that the prince was drawn to the monk and asked to speak to him. And in that conversation, he became so inspired that he decided to send the charioteer back to the palace alone and shave off his head and become a renunciate then and there. So these encounters with aging, illness, and death, followed by the encounter with a being that seemed to have a sense of calm, of peacefulness, were the messengers that led that prince into his renunciation. The Buddha tells his own story slightly differently. He says, "While I had power and good fortune, I thought, when an untaught person who is subject to aging, not safe from aging, sees another who is aged, he is shocked, humiliated, and disgusted, for he forgets that he himself is no exception. But I too am subject to aging, not safe from aging, and so it cannot befit me to be shocked, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another who is aged. When I considered this, the vanity of youth entirely left me. I thought, when an untaught ordinary woman who is subject to sickness, not safe from sickness, sees another who is sick, she is shocked, humiliated, and disgusted, for she forgets that she herself is no exception. But I too am subject to sickness, not safe from sickness, so it cannot befit me to be shocked, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another who is sick. When I considered this, the vanity of health entirely left me. I thought, when an untaught ordinary person who is subject to death, not safe from death, sees another who is dead, he is shocked, humiliated, and disgusted, for he forgets that he himself is no exception. But I too am subject to death. So it cannot befit me to be shocked, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another who is dead. When I considered this, the vanity of life entirely left me. So aging, sickness, and death can be wake-up calls for us. They can be strong pointers to us. And yet we normally don't consider them as divine messengers. We don't consider them as heavenly messengers. We consider them as something to be either shocked, humiliated, and disgusted about, or fearful of. In the suttas also, there's a story about how people are ignorant, ignore these messengers. This story is about a man who was not the nicest person. And it says, after death, he was reborn in a bad destination in hell. And there he met the Lord of Death. The Lord of Death then asked the man, "Didn't you ever see the first heavenly messenger?" And the man said, "No, I don't think I ever saw the first heavenly messenger." And the Lord of Death replies to him, "But didn't you ever see a woman or man aged 80, 90, or 100 years, frail, bent like a roof bracket, crooked, leaning on a stick, shakily going along, ailing, youth and vigor gone, with broken teeth, with gray and scanty hair, or none, wrinkled and blotched limbs?" And the man replied, "Yes, I've seen that." And the Lord of Death said to him, "Didn't it ever occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, I too am subject to age and cannot escape it? Let me do noble deeds of body, speech, and mind." "No, I could not do it," he said. "I was negligent." The same goes on for the other two, illness and death. We ignore these as messengers. We don't consider that we too will age, sicken, and die. As we age, we become more, able to take these truths in. There's another quote from the Mahabharata, an ancient Indian epic poem. In this poem, one of the people in the poem is asked, "What is the greatest wonder?" And he replies, "This, I think, is most wonderful, that the man of the world, even though he is seeing before his eyes constantly creatures dying and passing away, never for a moment the idea enters him, 'I too have to fall. I am also a creature destined to be destroyed.' Even if it is told to him, it never enters his mind. Only the surface mind understands the language, but the actual sense never goes into his head. That every man must one day die, yet every man lives as if they were immortal. This is the greatest wonder." What that teaching is really pointing to is so true, that we know intellectually somehow that we will die. But the truth of it doesn't seem to enter us that easily. The Buddha pointed to these 3, aging, illness, and death. I think they are considered divine messengers because they point us directly. Every day, over and over again, we can be pointed to the truths of impermanence and suffering. These very deep truths about all experience. And contemplation of them, of aging, illness, and death, can open our hearts very deeply. And the Buddha actually recommended that we reflect on these truths regularly. Frequently recollect, I am subject to aging, I am subject to illness, I am subject to death. Reminding yourself over and over. Now, this is not meant to be a depressing reflection. It actually is meant to soften the heart, open the heart, and connect us to our fellow human beings. Because we see through this reflection that not only we are subject to aging, illness, and death, but everyone around us. And with this, the heart seems to soften. The heart can soften. This is from the Dhammapada. Many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize this, quarrels end. So this can be a helpful reflection when one is experiencing frustration or anger or irritation in a relationship. Reflecting on this, I'm subject to death. This person is subject to death. Carlos Castaneda said, Don Juan says, an immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture towards you. So aging, sickness, and death are the messengers from our conventional lives, from our everyday lives, that point to deep truths. The deep truths that all conditioned things are impermanent. Every experience is subject to aging and death, is a way to look at how our experience unfolds. Every experience has its own life. It arises, it lives for a while, it fades and disappears. And because all of our experience is impermanent, inherently, our experience is not a place where we can rest and find ultimate happiness. That essentially, because things are changing, we can't find anything in our world that we can hold on to as a lasting source of happiness. Either we try to get something and we fail, or we get something and it will fade away. And we if we are holding on to that thing with the idea that this will make me happy, we will suffer when that thing naturally becomes impermanent. Usually we seek for happiness in the world. Usually we think that we can find happiness through getting the things we like, arranging our life with people that we're friends with, and things, objects in our world that make us comfortable, or getting rid of the things that we don't like, and not having to spend time with the people we don't like. If we can just arrange our world, we would be happy. But this exercise is an exercise in endless work, because every time we arrange it, it changes. Rainer Maria Rilke says, "And we, spectators, always, everywhere, turn toward the world of objects. It fills us. We arrange it. It breaks down. We rearrange it, then break down ourselves. Who has twisted us around like this so that no matter what we do, we are in the posture of someone going away? Just as upon the farthest hill, which shows him his whole valley one last time, he turns, stops, lingers. So we live here forever taking leave." There's not really any way to arrange our world so that it's once and for all the way we like it. We continually have to rearrange and rearrange and rearrange and rearrange, and it falls apart, and rearrange it and falls apart. And endlessly, we think this is going to make us happy. So the teachings on impermanence point us back to something. This is really what the Buddha was searching for. Is there something, some kind of happiness that's not dependent on conditions? Not dependent on the impermanent nature of the world. So turning to our experience, rather than endlessly trying to figure out how to fix the world, turning towards the desire to fix the world, and noticing that that too is impermanent. When we notice that the desire to fix the world is impermanent, we have hit upon a deep kind of happiness. If you actually bring your attention at some point to the wanting of something, what does it feel like to want something? It's a feeling that things are not right. There's a kind of a dissatisfied experience because you want something. The things are not the way you want them to be. What is that feeling itself? What does that wanting itself feel like? Can you hang out with that feeling? Notice that it passes away. Notice that it is impermanent. In that ending of the wanting, you will have a sense of a happiness that's not dependent on having what you want, but on letting go of needing things to be any particular way. You'll have a pointer to the happiness that the Buddha discovered. But typically we are focused out into the world, and in an exploration of that, we can also understand impermanence. We can understand impermanence at the everyday level, understanding it through just observing our world, getting familiar with the fact that things change. I mean, this is not news. It's not news. Everybody knows this. Things change. But again, it's the surface mind that understands. It's not felt that deeply. So reflect on the changing experience of your world. Actually, you can tune into that. This is a good time of year to tune into that. the autumn, the fall, where the trees start to change color, the leaves fall off the trees. It's a beautiful image of impermanence. And we can also use our meditation to reflect on impermanence, the impermanent nature of our experience, the impermanent nature of our body. On Monday morning, several of us gathered with Rainbow. It was a way of expressing a parting with her. And in that parting ceremony, Gil said some words. He reminded Rainbow that earth returns to earth, water returns to water, air returns to air, fire returns to fire, space returns to space, and consciousness can be released. So even that reflection, I mean, thinking of the body, we can reflect on the body as simply elements, the hard parts, the bones, the muscles, the solid parts. They'll all return to the earth at some level, whether they decompose and are eaten by maggots, and then the maggots excrete things, and that becomes the earth, or the body simply rots and becomes earth. The watery parts of our body will ultimately evaporate into the air and come down as rain. Water returns to water. The heat element, the heat in our body, dissipates into the heat in the world. The space in our body, all the spaces, the cavities inside of our body, in our stomach, in our hearts, in our intestine, all of that space will be returned to the space. So in just reflecting on our bodies and how they will fall apart, how they'll decompose, this actually is a reflection that the Buddha suggested in the Satipatthana Sutta. Reflecting on that the body will decompose. And we can reflect on it through this elemental exploration. And we can also, in a meditative, experiential way. So what I was just expressing was more of a reflection, a thought experiment, thinking about what will happen to your body when you die. In a meditative way, we can also explore our body through the elements. The earth component of our body is experienced as heaviness. As weight. Right now, feeling your body, can you tune into the heavy element, the feeling of gravity pulling the body down, the pressure, the density. One way to explore the earth element, touch your tongue against your teeth and feel the hardness. That's a manifestation of earth, that hardness. Then noticing in that touching of the tongue to the teeth that there's a pushing that happens. That pushing is a manifestation of movement, which is the air element. Air element felt as pushing, movement, vibration, tingling. Sitting here in your body now, actually, put your attention in your hands. It's pretty easy to feel the air element in the hands. Feeling any tingling or vibration, pulsing. The water element. Touching into the experience of saliva in your mouth. The fluidity. The liquidity, the fire element, and the experience of heat or coolness in your body. We can explore our body in an elemental way through the direct experience of our body. The direct experience of pressure, vibration, tingling, pulsing, liquid, coolness, heat. Instead of through concepts, we typically experience our body through a conceptual framework of our body. We think hand. We think we feel hand. We think we feel foot. But if you put your attention in your hand, and feel what you feel, there's no hand there. It's just tingling, vibration, pulsing, pressure, creaking. So the experiential meditation on impermanence in the body points to the level of experience below concept. One of the main ways we delude ourselves into believing in permanence is through the world of concepts. We overlay concepts on top of things, and through the concepts, we hold on to our ideas of things and create things that are what we consider more permanent. But when we touch into the actual experience in our bodies, we see that nothing lasts for very long. No experience lasts for more than a few seconds at most. What even feels like something that's lasting for a while, for example, the pressure of your butt on the chair, touch into that feeling. Feels like it's lasting, but if you hang out there, you might start noticing pulsing, tingling, pressure that is not constant. These experiences are the pointers to the impermanent nature of our experience. So as I mentioned before, this meditation or reflection on impermanence is, it doesn't have to be a depressing thought. Reflection on aging, illness, and death. It doesn't have to be depressing. When we really acknowledge this as a truth, it opens us. We have a sense of shared humanity, a shared sense of fragility, a shared sense of we're not so different. And this opens us to compassion. It's a natural response when the heart is open and it meets suffering. The natural response is compassion. And to me, this is part of what the fourth messenger that the Buddha described was about. Is this open heart, meeting the open heart, meeting the possibility of an open heart in the face of aging, illness, and death, in the face of impermanence, in the face of suffering. That is inspirational. If we're willing to engage, and sometimes I think we move into a spiritual teaching because of an encounter with suffering. We move into wanting to understand why. Why is there suffering? Is there a way to not suffer? And sometimes we think that perhaps if I practice long enough, then somehow I'll be detached from suffering. But I think what really happens is that we really open to it. We stop resisting it. And that is the transformation. When the open heart, when the heart opens, it can meet both the sorrow and the joy with balance, with equanimity. I'll end the talk with a quote from I think he's a Western monk in the Thai forest tradition. His name is Pra Kantipalo. Everything in everybody, that includes you and me, deteriorates, ages, decays, breaks up, and passes away. And we, living in the forest of desires, are entirely composed of the impermanent. Yet our desire impels us not to see this, though impermanence stares us in the face from every single thing around. And it confronts us when we look within, mind and body arising and passing away. So don't turn on the TV, go to the pictures, read a book, see some food, or 100 other distractions just to avoid seeing this. This is the only thing really worth seeing. For one who fully sees it is free. So, I'm interested in your thoughts on this subject. Yeah, Maureen.
Could you read the last quote that you read again, please?
Everything in everybody, that includes you and me, deteriorates, ages, decays, breaks up and passes away. And we, living in the forest of desires, are entirely composed of the impermanent. Yet our desire impels us not to see this, though impermanence stares us in the face from every single thing around. And it confronts us when we look within, mind and body arising and passing away. So don't turn on the TV, go to the pictures, read a book, seize some food, or 100 other distractions just to avoid seeing this. This is the only one thing really worth seeing, for one who sees it fully is free. Yeah, Mary Ellen. Wait for the microphone.
I intellectually understand what you're talking about, and I do contemplate aging, illness, and death. And yet there's a part of me that wants, like St. Augustine, to have this liberation and freedom, but not yet. And so it's a real conflict to let go, because sometimes it stymies me and I'm confused almost as to how I would sit in that place and not have... Does it stop you from seeking relationship, from wanting to fall in love, from things that are desires, but they're so important and they're vibrant parts of life? And there's just a little way in which this kind of bums me out.
Well, the way that the Buddha instructed us is to meet where we are. So, you know, where we are right now isn't at the point of being completely able to let go into this. So what we do is we look at where we are stuck, where we meet resistance. Look at the resistance. We don't have to jump over the resistance. We don't have to pretend that we don't want to have a relationship. We don't want to be involved with somebody or fall in love. We don't have to pretend that. We do need to look at the way we are putting our lives together. We do need to look at what we are assuming will bring us happiness. Looking at it clearly, is this really bringing me happiness? You know, over time, I mean, I taught, I think it was a, maybe it was on a Monday, I taught a teaching about gratification, danger, and escape from sense desire. I don't think that was on a Thursday night, but one of the aspects of that teaching that I love is that it points us to really contemplating what is the gratification of sense pleasure. So not to jump over it, but really to understand it. What's gratifying about it? And how long does it last? How gratifying is it, really, in the ultimate sense? Is that what we are really looking for? Or is there something more that we are looking for? So the instructions are really to meet our experience here and now, and to not have to, you know, think about, okay, well, gee, you know, if I get fully enlightened, then, well, I'm not going to want all those things that I want right now, and that bums me out. Well, you know, if you get fully enlightened and you don't want them, no problem. Right now, you work with where you are. And I do find, you know, the more I engage in this practice, it's like my whole life just shifts. It's the things I used to want, I don't want anymore. It's not a problem. You know, not wanting is not a problem.
I'll look forward to that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is relationship incompatible with enlightenment?
I think you might hear different versions of that. Ajahn Shanti would probably say no. I don't know, because I'm not fully enlightened. The stories in the suttas claim that at the third stage of enlightenment, so that enlightenment has four stages, and at the first stage we let go of the view of self. We let go of the idea that rites and rituals will do something for us. And we let go of doubt in the possibility of awakening. The second stage of awakening is a little bit of an attenuation of greed and aversion. At the third stage of awakening, it is said that desire and aversion completely disappear. And at that point, the stories in the suttas indicate that people who have been married, who have attained that stage, no longer have sexual relationship, that they're not engaged in sexual relationship. At the fourth stage of awakening, generally in the suttas, it's said that the person would go and become a monastic. But, you know, as a monastic, you're in relationship. I mean, you don't necessarily have an intimate relationship with a single person. But I look at the Buddha as having very intimate relationships with the people that he taught. I mean, at the deepest level of their being, the Buddha was touching them and opening their hearts. So I think partly it depends on the kind of relationship you're talking about. And, you know, again, I can't really know. I don't know. But I can, you know, just say those few words. And again, I wouldn't worry about it. You know, if I get to the third stage of enlightenment and I no longer have desire or aversion, that would be pretty good, I think. You know, and if that meant that I no longer had a desire for an intimate relationship, that wouldn't be a problem either. Yeah, Tracy.
For a long time, I've been wanting to go and like volunteer at like a senior home or somewhere where people are sick. But I have this fear of like, what if I get overwhelmed by that, or it, you know, brings me down? Mm-hmm. Is that where like equanimity or just some wisdom and knowing if you're ready for something like that would come in?
You know, you could explore it without committing to, you know, being there for a long time. You could essentially, you know, run a test for yourself and see what happens. I would encourage you to explore something like that. If you've had the thought, or, you know, if you've had that thought to explore a hospice or volunteering in a nursing home or something, I would encourage you to do that and try it. I found it, you know, it's interesting. At one point I realized that I had never seen a human being dead. I was 47 years old before I saw my first dead body. And that was in Burma. But before that, I realized that this was a huge gap in my life. You know, I had not gone to the funerals of my grandparents. My parents had not wanted me to, you know, be exposed to that or something. Or maybe it was just that we were so far away, they didn't want to take me there. I don't know. But I just didn't have exposure to death. And at one point on a retreat, I was doing some walking meditation on this edge of a stupa. There was about a 4-foot drop on the edge of the stupa. And I was walking, and I stumbled a little bit and, you know, lost my balance. And I had a split-second image of myself falling and smashing my head on the pavement 4 feet below. And I realized that split second, that might have been my death in that moment. It might have been my death. And that for me was a kind of an interesting turn. It's like, oh, you know, this can happen at any time, anywhere. It's not a distant thing, you know. So I really felt the need at that point to meet the experience of dying. And so I decided at that point to volunteer at a hospice. And I spent some time at the bedsides of people who were dying. And I found it to actually be a very moving experience. Sitting with them, as a practitioner, you know, sitting with them, wishing them well, wishing them peace, wishing them ease, just sitting in meditation with somebody who is dying is a very opening experience. And it reminds us, I mean, when we are sitting in meditation with someone who's dying, we are not closed to the possibility that this might be us. And so the fear begins to dissipate. The fear of it begins to dissipate. Yes, I encourage you. Let's sit for the last few minutes. For this last few minutes, I'll do a little bit of metta for the spirit of Rainbow, who left us on Tuesday. So allowing your body to relax. And settle your attention into the area around your heart. Just noticing what you feel there. There's no right or wrong feeling. Just noticing what's there. And connecting to, if you know Rainbow, an image of her, or the feeling of being with her. And if not, if you don't know Rainbow, just using her name, Rainbow, may you be at ease. Rainbow, may you be at peace. Rainbow, may your heart be completely released, completely freed. And moving out to wish peace and ease for others who may be dying this evening. There are people around the planet who are dying this evening. May you be at ease. May you be at peace. May your heart be completely freed and opening our hearts to the loved ones of those who have died. The Rainbow's family, her brother Michael and his wife, all those who may be in pain through the loss of a loved one, may your heart be at ease. May you be at peace. May your heart be free from suffering. And to all beings everywhere, may all beings be peaceful. May all beings be at ease. May all beings know the truth of impermanence and open their hearts to aging, illness, and death, not being frightened of it. And through this movement of opening to our shared humanity, May the whole world lay down weapons. Put aside quarrels and dissent. And live peacefully. May all beings be free. Thank you for your attention.